Crystal Wilkinson has become the first black woman to be appointed Kentucky Poet Laureate. She's the author of The Birds of Opulence, Blackberries, Blackberries, Water Street, and the forthcoming collection Perfect Black. She also serves as Associate Professor of English at the University of Kentucky. She joined me recently in the studio to talk about her writing and becoming Kentucky's next Poet Laureate. Crystal Wilkinson, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you describe your experience growing up in rural Kentucky?
Well, I was raised by my grandparents on 64 acres of land. My grandfather was a farmer. My grandmother was a domestic worker and also a farmer. I went to live with them when I was 6 weeks old. I was actually born in Hamilton, Ohio. My mother had suffered from mental illness, so my grandparents came to get me when I was 6 weeks old, came to pick up my mother too in Ohio, and we went home, and that's where I grew up. I think my childhood, I always describe it as sort of being enchanted. All of my mother's siblings had moved away. My mother eventually moved to Lexington. And so I was a grandchild being raised by grandparents on this farm. So by then my grandfather had made his money. So it wasn't like I had to work on the farm the way that my mother and my aunts and uncles had. So I was sort of free. I had this wonderful freedom as a child to explore the land, to sort of dwell in my imagination. And I really think that upbringing is what made me become a writer.
You've often cited your grandmother as a significant influence on the writer that you've become. Can you tell me about her?
Yeah, I think both my grandparents influenced who I am now and me becoming a writer. In some ways, you know, they were, of course, were farming people, were rural people. They wouldn't have called themselves that, but Appalachian people, you know, they were from the hills. But they also had an appreciation for forms of art, for made things. My grandfather whittled and whistled and had an appreciation for music, all kinds of music, gospel, bluegrass gospel. And my grandmother was a maker in her own right. She quilted and sewed, and she actually wrote songs. Found a lot of her, they really were poems written on the back of envelopes, and she always had a little notepad that she was writing things on. And she was an avid reader and encouraged me to be an avid reader. I knew how to read before I went to school because of my grandmother. And she read to me every night, and I eventually learned how to read the books back to her. And so I knew how to read before I went to school. I was already in love with books. And so definitely she had a great influence on me becoming a writer.
You mentioned having sort of this relationship with the land as a result of growing up on the farm. Is this why place is such an important aspect in your writing?
I think so. I mean, I think it's ingrained in me. I think I was able to see the land in, of course, a very utilitarian way, if that's the word for it. You know, I have a poem called Oh Tobacco that's an ode to tobacco. Tobacco was our cash crop on our farm, and my grandfather also did a little bit of everything. We had a few dairy cattle. We lived off the land, but then so much of the land was left alone to sort of be admired. I don't know if they thought of it that way. I also think that solitude and being sort of one with the land was a big influence on me too, because I know that there was a lot of it. And then, you know, my grandfather would only sort of occupy little small pockets for what he was doing on the farm. And the rest of it was sort of kept neat, but sort of left alone for us to sort of enjoy. I saw in him, when I would go to work with him out in the fields, that's when his face would become softer when he was walking those fields. And we were a very quiet people. I was a very bashful, shy child that didn't talk very much. And my grandfather was a very sort of stoic man. And so those walks through the fields, through the meadows, and through the knobs were very meditative. Those walks with my grandmother to the creek to get water or to the well to get water were very meditative. I think that was my first, that was my first entryway into the land in a sort of a deep way. And that still stays with me. I've been, of course, away from home longer than I was there. But that love of the land and that memory of the land certainly stays with me.
Can you describe your reaction when you discovered that you'd been named Poet Laureate?
Oh, wow. You know, it's growing toward the end of the semester, and I think all professors and students, anyone who's involved in the academy starts to get testy, and, you know, we're all like, you know, we're almost at the end, lots of grading, and I'm also working on a few deadlines for different writing projects. So I got an email that just said something like, we need your help with a project. Can we talk to you on the phone? And I was kind of like eager to see what they were talking about, but a little thing in the back of my mind was going, oh my goodness, another project. I can't possibly. And so it was sort of a surprise. So when I got on the phone was the first notion that I had. And they said, you know, you've been named Kentucky Poet Laureate. And I immediately started crying. Because I immediately thought of that list of the poet laureates before me. On that list are mentors, either on the page or in person, and friends and people who I've long admired, some who are no longer with us on this side. And so it was just really emotional. I immediately started crying. I couldn't. They were saying, well, do you accept? And my voice was cracking.
So what message do you hope to send as the Poet Laureate, especially to young Black girls and people of color?
Well, I think that's important. I hope that the message is that they can do whatever they would like to. I hope the message is that they can become writers. I didn't know that until later. I loved books and I loved writing. But I thought of it as possibly a hobby. Like I didn't have any books that were written by Black people, didn't have any books that were written by Black women. I didn't even have any books that were written by Kentuckians. And so I hope that it gives them, makes their back straighter, and it gives them the idea that they can do anything they want to. They certainly can become Poet Laureate if they want to. They can become a writer. So I hope it sends that message.
Can you describe for me the feeling and maybe an example of seeing someone that you can relate to in writing? What does that feel like? And what kind of effect does that have on a person?
Anytime you can see yourself. And, you know, I had layers of that. So I would read books where there were rural characters and I could see myself there. I was like, oh, that's a little girl out in the woods. I can relate. You know, I can see myself in that. And then I read someone like Ernest Gaines and I said, oh my gosh, these are rural Black country folks. I can see myself. I see my grandfather and I see the people from my church in this writing. I can see all that so clearly. And then to come forward, you know, many years later, and to see the work of someone like Gail Jones, who's a native Kentuckian, and to see Kentucky Black rural people in a piece of writing that's written so purely and so lyrical, and the language, the dialect is right. And it was just amazing. It opened me up to a whole other realm of possibilities in my own work. And there's nothing like, I don't think there's, you know, even outside of writing, there's nothing like being seen, especially if, as a young person, to be seen clearly, to be able to see yourself on the screen or on the page, at the podium, in the White House. Just amazing. And I think that sometimes people in mainstream society, they don't really realize what an impact that has on a person to see yourself. It shifts your whole reality and shifts your reality of possibility and thinking about what is possible for yourself. Yeah, it shifts everything.
What does writing do for you personally?
I think it changes. It changes about every decade. I think in the beginning, what it did for me was give me a voice because I didn't really have one. No one was keeping me quiet. It was just a part of my personality to be really bashful and shy. And I think I still have some of those things. So I think it gave me a voice. And then it shifted to this possibility that I could give a voice to someone who hasn't had an opportunity to have their voices heard. And so then it became this whole other thing that I, through my writing, could give voice to, not directly to my people, because, you know, in my fiction, of course, I wasn't writing nonfiction, but I felt like I was making visible or making more visible my people, my heritage, my county, my state, and sort of pushing it out for the world to see that we existed. My first book got published and I began to tour, even though Black people have been writing about rural characters for forever. I'm certainly not the first one, but there's something about the way that people see Kentucky. As I was traveling, when I was touring on that very first tour, especially on the second one with Water Street, people were saying things like, you know, oh, two things. It was always, you're Black and from Kentucky, and then the sort of fascination with my accent was the other one. Like, you're speaking like that, you know, and you're a Black woman. So, because I think that, of course, the Kentucky dialect is different from sort of the deep Southern dialect. We're accustomed to seeing that dialect on television and in our books and in our films. But the Black Kentucky dialect is not one that people are accustomed to seeing. Being able to tell the truth of my people through characters and through my work has been one of the greatest experience, I think, of being a writer. And to get my own truth told in these various ways, because poetry, of course, lends itself to something that fiction doesn't. And then fiction lends itself to something that nonfiction doesn't. And it's very circuitous of how all of the genres work together, the way they're sort of in conversation with each other, and the way they communicate a message to the reader. And I think I consider myself fortunate to dabble in all of the genres with, as I'm learning now, that this new book is going to come out in August, that poetry, even more than nonfiction, is scary for me. Fiction I'm comfortable with because nobody knows how much of myself, even when I tell you that there's a thread of truth in this story or in this novel, you don't really know how much. And then in nonfiction, I'm telling it head on, so I'm coming to the table with a certain amount of exposure. But there's something that feels vulnerable, I think, about poetry. Even though the speaker of the poem may not always be me, I feel like I've, in some way, put my most vulnerable self on the page.
One of my favorite essays is Dig, If You Will, the Picture. Just because you're here and because I love it. Will you talk to me a little bit about that essay?
After Prince died, I have to tell a Prince story to get to the essay. So I've always been a huge Prince fan, and I've always sort of been made fun of for being such a rabid fan. And I never got a chance to see him in person. In fact, that's still something that Ron is my partner still paying for, not buying me tickets to see Prince when I think the tickets were something outrageous, $300 or something, yeah, when he was here in Kentucky. But it was right before he died, like just less than a year before he died. So we still had the bookstore, and there had been that close call, I don't know, a month maybe before he died. And, you know, I was searching frantically online, and they said, oh, he's fine. He was spotted on his bike in Minnesota. Everything's cool. And then he died. Someone who was a regular in the bookstore came in. I looked over at one of the baristas, and she was doing that sort of throat, like, be quiet kind of move, like, don't say anything. And I was just looking at her, and She looked at Ron, and Ron was shaking his head no. And then she just blurted it out. She said, did you all hear that Prince died? And I just started weeping. And she was like, she said, oh, did she know Prince personally? And they just like got her coffee and got her out. And I had a really hard time. People were sending me flowers. And I got gifts and cards because people knew how much I loved him. So when the Oxford American asked me to write an essay, I had gone sort of through my grieving process. And I decided that I was going to make fun of myself as this uber fan. But as I sat down to write the essay, more and more things started coming up, and I would sort of push them away. And I was like, no, 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 this is supposed to be light and fun. And I didn't know why I loved Prince so much until I wrote that essay. And sort of it connected to, you know, sexual abuse in the church and things that I hadn't even thought about for a really long time. All of that sort of bubbled up to the surface in that essay. And I finally said, okay, you know, if this is what this essay is going to be about, then that's what it's going to be about. And I finished it and sent it off to the editor. They liked it and decided to publish it. And that was also another vulnerable moment because I was very proud of it. It felt very relieved to have written it. And then suddenly, of course, it was in the world. And it had been published, and I was getting emails about it and back messages on my social media being asked to speak about it. And so that was my first sort of direct, you know, I'd written about my mother and her mental illness and had a sort of the same reaction, but that was the first sort of big reaction from a reading public about my nonfiction. And I was kind of like, whoa. But I felt like by that point I was ready for that. That essay was the first essay that was hard to write about, even harder, I think, more difficult than writing about my mother's mental illness.
In a lot of ways, a writer becomes a more public person than the sort of celebrities that you would see in a movie or on television, because you're putting so much of yourself out there. Is that the sort of fear and apprehension that you felt when you share those sorts of stories, especially the nonfiction stuff?
I think so. It's not so much, honestly, it's not so much that I'm pretty much an open book, you know, so if someone sits and talks to me long enough, you know, the thing about writing is that I discover new things about myself when I'm writing these pieces. So if something's new that has bubbled up, that feels fresh. But I'm pretty much an open book. If someone talks, I'm very chatty. If someone talks to me long enough, they'll know all my stories anyway. So that doesn't really bother. And so many of those stories are sort of sprinkled around in the fiction. But I think what affects me most is how it affects other people. Because I like your writing is one thing. But when people respond and say, oh, I had that same experience, or my sister loved this so much because of this, or my wife carried this around with her for 3 days because she had a similar experience. And so a lot of those emails and back messages were those kinds of stories. And so then there was that sort of processing my own trauma and then sort of processing other people's trauma too, which was difficult, but was also nice that that essay had enabled other people to have that I had this common experience with other people. And they were then sharing their stories, many for the first time.
So in a way, it helps you connect with people.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And I think especially for someone who is, I can't say that I'm shy anymore, but who's sort of reserved, which I think a lot of those of us that are writers, artists, really, I think a lot of us are sort of reserved in that way. So I've come to like that part of the process. But like I said, even nonfiction, when I'm trying to find an artful way to process pain or to process trauma, it is a made thing. It's not sort of just this spewing out of angst or experience or trauma or sort of pathology or whatever. My intent, of course, is to make it art and to transfer it from my own experience to something in the reader.
Something you mentioned, I think, is pretty interesting. You know, a lot of times when you talk to fiction writers about where their stories come from, they'll say, well, I kind of start with this character and then I don't know where it's going. I just kind of start writing and I see where it's going to go. And you mentioned this when writing Dig, If You Will, the picture. You had these intentions when you sat down to write it, but then the story just keeps creeping up and wants to pull you in a different direction. And eventually it sounds like you decided to listen and say, yeah, okay, I'm going to let this story go in the direction it wants to go in.
I mean, I think that's part of, at least it's part of my process, that I've learned to do that. Because if I had written this sort of, one was the tradition, so the form even changed because I thought I needed a more artful way. Once these other things begin to bubble up, it ceased being a traditional essay because I didn't think the traditional essay in my own mind and in my own sort of process and my imagination as a writer, I couldn't bear it straight on. Even the fact that it became a lyric essay was because of what bubbled up to the surface, because it was going to be a very sort of straightforward essay with humor in my mind is what I was going to do. That was going to be how I processed, because I didn't want to just sort of turn up the grief, because I knew I had already been grieving for Prince. So I didn't want to just turn that on. I wanted to sort of process it with humor. And of course, that didn't happen. But I'm pleased with the essay in the end.
So your next book is slated for release in August. It's titled Perfect Black. What can you tell us about the book?
I would describe it. Well, one, the poems and the prose and the lyrics in that book are an amalgam of pieces that I've written over the years. So in some ways, some of them are sort of collected and selected poems. Other pieces are newer. In some ways, it's sort of a memoir in poems and lyrics. It starts out with girlhood, and then there's the second section is more womanhood and development, and the third section is more sort of coming into activism and sort of the political realm. And even though all the pieces are not necessarily me, like the big I, but they are certainly parts of me in that maturation from girlhood to adulthood to a more consciousness, a more awareness of what's going on in the culture and what's going on in the country.
Will you read something to us?
Sure. This is a piece. Well, before I read this, I wanted to say that one of the things that's happened to me as a writer is that all those genres, I'm no longer the poet over here and the essayist over here and the fiction writer over here. I think that I bring to every piece that I write now, at least this moment that I'm writing in, all of those are together. And so this is a piece that was published in the Kenyon Review. And it's called A Meditation on Grief, Things We Carry, Things We Remember. I remember this place where burdens wash away in the dark and mother's dresses float like blossoms. A boy drowns, his head turned toward home, body facing the farmer's house where the girl who loves him sleeps. She is the farmer's daughter. They say she is the one who hit his head, the one who hoisted the rock, the one who watched his blood ooze out. This is the way you wash your clothes in the creek. This is the way you catch catfish in deep water. The mothers stand in water to their knees, their dresses wafting out like sheets on a line. On the creek bank, a child runs circles, catching the wind, and the mother's dresses float like blossoms. The mothers sing prayers for the boy's mother, who looks out her kitchen window and cries. The circle of mothers in the water whisper a prayer for the girl who tells all who will listen that she loved the boy who died. Her mother stands in the backyard, her hand on the chopping hoe, with tears streaming down her face. The fathers brood in the fields, walking slow as lepers, hearts and houses filled with grief. I almost drowned once. My grandmother's dress blossomed around her like a sail. She was my John Boat in the creek. My mother stood on the shore, frozen with fear, my father's name mute on her tongue, his kiss spoiled fruit in her young sweet mouth. That dead boy's ghost haunts this place, dark water flowing like a deacon's robe. On nights spoiled with teenage trouble, I went to the creek and waited for the boy, hoping he would listen. "Do you dream of the farmer's daughter?" I asked. "Are you sorry for what you've done?" He didn't answer. They say he raped the girl, but I wasn't afraid of him. By then, I had been raped too and was becoming a dangerous woman. I waited for him and held court with the moon. "I'm here," I said. "Let's get this done." In this place where burdens washed away, I stood, my dress flowering, floating. I was drowning too. My face turned toward home, my black body facing my father's house where my mother cried for me. They say the boy was handsome, but I never saw him in the flesh. At night, the creek did scare me, its rush like a boy's whispered threat in a girl's ear. But here, the mothers are always standing with water to their knees, their dresses billowing out like sheets on a line, praying because there was always something roaring in those trees, teeth gnashing, fathers killing boys for the sake of their daughters, eyes always watching, eyes always glistening in the dark.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Oof. Talk to me about water in this poem.
I think the water, of course, provides the movement. I think that I often use water. This is how I've sort of processed one of the sort of traumas from my childhood, the way it sort of moves through this poem. I almost drowned once as a child, and so that recurs in my fiction, recurs in essays, recurs in poems, not in any direct way, as far as being directly related to my own experience, but it's often there as a rudder. And so it's both emotional for me, and sort of the physicality of water moving is something that sort of continues to haunt me and sort of haunts my work.
What does this poem symbolize to you?
It's a poem that I have walked around. It actually, well, some version of it appears twice in the new book, because part of that is because I have continued to play with form. So it appears as the creek in the new book, Perfect Black. And it also appears in the same form as it appeared in the Kenya Review. And I come back to the piece. And so it's also a piece that people talk a lot, and it's been taught in regard to what is it? You know, is it a poem? I think it was originally published as flash fiction. And then someone recently connected with me because they want to use it as a flash essay in an anthology. So I find it interesting, the form interesting. The other form in the book, it's written in couplets down the page. Here it appears in prose form.
Does that matter to you? Does it matter how other people interpret the form?
I wouldn't say it matters to me. I just find it interesting because it's also an interesting part of my process. So I find it interesting when people try to say, you know, they try to answer that question, what is this? And sometimes I think it's an emotional answer. Sometimes I think it's an editorial answer, depending on where they're writing or teaching or reading from. I mean, it's not a judgment or... It doesn't really matter to me, because it doesn't matter to me when I'm writing it either, which gets me in trouble, of course, with publishers and editors.
They like to have rules.
Yeah, they do. And there are rules. I mean, we have to have rules. But I've certainly, I think when I wrote the novel, The Birds of Opulence, you know, I had tried to write that novel for a long time in a more traditional way. So I thought, well, if I'm going to my other books are, you know, I had a short story collection and then I had a short story cycle. And if this is going to be my first novel, it needs to be a hefty, straightforward, recognizable novel with a linear through line. I sort of wrestled with that for years. And I had this big bulky thing at one point, but it didn't feel true. And so I went back through and I distilled it down and boiled it down, edited it the way that I would edit a poem, sort of line by line, page by page, and it felt more real to me. It felt like if I'm going to write about ancestral memory and I'm going to write about mental illness, then it needs to be written in this sort of distilled way, addressing all those different kind of writers. So I need to bring, the poet needs to be present, the essayist needs to be present, and the fiction writer needs to be present in the same body. And so since that epiphany, when I'm writing something, all those writers within me are present. You know, it sort of happens naturally. I'm like, okay, I need the poet now. You know, this is, and usually that the poet steps forward when there's something difficult to process, like the way that that happened with the dig, if you will, the picture, that essay. The poet kind of steps forth and says, okay, I have the language. Let's deal with this with some metaphorical language here so that not only you, meaning pointing back to me, the writer, but the reader can deal with this information in a beautiful way.
So in the time that we've got left, young readers, older readers, anybody who is thinking about picking up the pen for the first time, as the poet laureate, what message do you have to anybody who listens to this and wants to write?
Just do it. I loved hearing Ernest Gaines talk about writing. Someone asked him that question, like, what can I do? I really want to write. And he sort of got quiet and leaned forward. And we were all leaning forward like, oh, my God, what is he about to say? And he said, I have six things. We all had our pens up. And he said, read, 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 write, write, write. And I think that you have to read more, read what you love, read what you don't love. Lee Young Lee said something the other night that was beautiful. He said, you have to like grow your garden of books, books that mean something to you, ones that you love, ones that you learn from, and then you have to go and write.
Crystal Wilkinson, teacher, essayist, fiction writer, poet, poet laureate. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Crystal Wilkinson will be formally inducted as part of the Kentucky Writers Day celebration on April 23rd. The virtual ceremony will stream live on the Kentucky Arts Council Facebook page and YouTube channel. You can find more information about that at artscouncil.ky.gov.